reality. But what comes that is out of his control, he is content with. What he is given because of that effort, he is content with. As long as, you know, he is able to worship Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and he gets him closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. On the other side, that a person makes effort, obviously, but the effort is because he is seeking more and more and more, and he's not satisfied by getting with what he has. This leads to other things. For example, cheating. For example, backstabbing, backbiting, and also the other illicit and evil traits and evil deeds. Why? In order for a person to reach higher positions of wealth, of power, you know, of social position, and so on and so forth. So therefore, contentment is not only of wealth, contentment of anything and everything, whether it be wealth, financial status, same thing with wealth, social status, position, it's not important. What is important is that a person understands that all of this comes from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Inshallah, until next time, my dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Oh Lord, here I am pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no
The Debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marcia Hashimi. Appreciate you being with us. Well, it is not likely that any of the top brass of the Saudi Arabia at the start of their onslaught on Yemen thought that 6.5 years later they would still be fighting. And now it is the Yemeni military along with Ansarullah fighters who are now attacking Saudi Arabia. Yemeni army spokesman announced that Yemen had initiated retaliatory attacks inside of Saudi Arabia on the King Khalid military base in Nasser. Stay with us as we take a look at how the tables have turned on the Saudi regime.
The Yemeni army has carried out another successful massive operation that was announced by the spokesman for the Yemeni army, Yahya Sariya, who described the offensive as a major victory in the southern Saudi Jazan region.
There is no doubt that this operation will affect the Saudi enemy severely, especially as it comes at a time when the Marib fronts and other fronts are under much pressure. Thus, these back-to-back victories confirm Saudi Arabia's inability to achieve any of the goals declared at the beginning of the war. The Saudi-led coalition failed in the military confrontation, while the Yemeni army continued to significantly improve its capabilities.
The spokesman stated that this operation comes in response to the escalation of Saudi Arabia's war and its ongoing siege on Yemen. Military experts said this victory could be part of the ongoing talks as it will push Riyadh further to accept a fair political solution.
Every military operation, including the Jizan operation, has political dimensions. Saudi Arabia is an arrogant country that believes its capabilities and the support it receives by Britain and America will help it achieve something in the field. Today, the Yemeni army proved that it is capable of gaining military control and that the battle has moved deep inside Saudi soil. Saudi Arabia is forced to move forward a political solution, but militarily it has completely failed.
Earlier, Yemen's armed forces carried out a retaliatory attack against the King Khalid Air Base in Azir using Qassam K2 drones. The Saudi war has brought about the world's worst humanitarian crisis in Yemen, according to the United Nations.
Observers say the ongoing operation by the Yemeni army has sent a clear message to Saudi Arabia, and that is, as long as the Saudi war and siege against Yemen is persist, Yemen's army will carry out more massive retaliatory attacks deep inside the kingdom. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
I'd like to welcome my guest to this program, Director of Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, Zafar Bangash, out of Toronto, and Elijah Macneill, journalist and political analyst out of Brussels. Thank you both for being with us. Well, let's start it off in Toronto, and Zafar, how could the Saudis have miscalculated Yemen this much? I mean, they thought the war would not take more than a month or two. Your assessment?
Well, basically, the Saudi defense minister, who is now also the crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, when he was first appointed, he was full of arrogance. He thought that the Saudi army, because it is equipped with a lot of weapons, would be able to wipe out any Yemeni resistance. But what he did not realize was, number one, that the Saudi army is not motivated. In fact, they are not really capable of fighting. Number two, they underestimated the Yemenis' resistance. The point is that the Yemenis are fighting for their land, for their honor, for their principle. What the Saudis are doing is they are the aggressors. They want to occupy somebody else's land, and they want to install a puppet regime in Yemen. Obviously, that is not acceptable to the Yemeni people. Secondly, the Saudis counted on a number of mercenaries. In fact, they approached a number of countries, including countries like Pakistan and Egypt and so on, hoping that they would send their armed forces to support the Saudis, and these countries refused. So the Saudis had to resort to mercenaries from South America, from Africa, from Sudan, etc. But naturally, even these mercenaries cannot continue to wage a war on behalf of the Saudis. So as you mentioned, it's been more than 6 years, and I think the Saudi army and their soldiers, etc., have realized that this is a lost cause, and the best thing is not to put up a fight, and in fact, many of them are surrendering.
Well, Elijah, the Saudis initiated a ruthless onslaught on Yemen back in 2015, bombing civilian areas and infrastructure, and also implementing a land, air, and sea siege of the area. I mean, what was Riyadh really trying to accomplish with this type of violence against the civilian population in Yemen?
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming.
There are 2 points. First of all, Saudis are trying to submit Yemen to its control because Yemen is considered its backyard. And secondly, they are afraid of the influence of Iran in Yemen. This is what the Saudis tried, started the war, thinking that it is a promenade, and thinking that in a matter of weeks this will end. It has been 6 years, and during these 6 years, the Yemeni learned how to make their own bombs, have learned the art of war, and they have also learned how to retaliate. And what we have seen very recently in the last 24 hours, how the Yemeni are taking the initiative and attacking Jazan and making really strong progress. Now, what Saudi Arabia is doing is really destroying Yemen. The cost of war so far is estimated around $100 billion. And the only thing that Saudis have achieved so far is the destruction of the country where there is the largest humanitarian crisis ever against the poorest country in the Middle East. We saw the Yemenis are learning how to fight back, how to make missiles, and how to do their own drones and armed drones, and how to retaliate and hurt Saudi Arabia. And I think now the Saudis are trying to find a way out, but they want to gain in negotiation what they failed to gain in the war.
Okay.
Therefore, the Houthis... Yes, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, let me just get Zafar back in on this discussion. Although the Yemenis have been under a Saudi siege, Yemeni fighters and Houthis have continually improved, so much so that they are now attacking Saudi Arabia. What do you attribute this to? I mean, how are they able to do this despite the siege?
Well, I think we need to keep in mind that the Yemenis are one people that has never, ever surrendered to foreign forces. That goes to their credit. Secondly, as your guest pointed out, the Yemenis have been able to make immense progress in terms of developing their military capabilities. Yemen already had actually a missile industry before the Saudis launched a war against them, but it was not as advanced as it has come now. And thirdly, the Saudi army, they're not only totally incompetent, they're also demoralized. So what the Yemenis have been able to do is, because of their determination, because of the fact that their cause is just, they are fighting to defend their own land. They're not committing aggression. In fact, even the operations that they are carrying out inside Saudi Arabia in provinces like Jizan and Asir, these actually belong to the Yemeni people. These were illegally occupied by the Saudis in 1934. So perhaps this Saudi aggression against Yemen that was launched in March of 2015 may turn out to be a blessing in disguise for the Yemenis, despite the enormous sacrifices that they have had to make, but that they perhaps might be able to reclaim the land that the Saudis had illegally occupied back in 1934. So their cause is just, they are highly motivated, they are excellent fighters, they have never surrendered to any foreign forces. All of these factors actually go in favor of the Yemeni people.
Okay. Well, Elijah, I mean, how significant in your perspective that we've seen the Yemeni forces just attacking a military base by drone inside of Saudi Arabia, and we've seen other retaliatory attacks in dealing with oil tankers. How disruptive has this been?
I think that had significant effect on Saudi Arabia economy, reputation, and finance. We saw how the Yemeni were able to disrupt the oil flow from Saudi Arabia to the rest of the world for several days and or even for a couple of weeks. And we saw how the Yemeni were able to head inland in Saudi Arabia and to give back the same amount of, not the same amount, but to retaliate in Saudi Arabia in different area, even going toward far in Saudi Arabia, so 1,200 kilometers. We saw how the Yemeni were capable to force the Saudis to the negotiation table. Unfortunately, the Americans are negotiating on behalf of the Saudis now in Sana'a, and not the Saudis, because they don't have the skills or the courage to negotiate.
Well, what about that, Zafai? Elijah talked about the Americans negotiating on behalf of the Saudis. Your perspective on the United States, do you think that at this point in time that they want this war to end? Are you detecting some type of changing perspective coming out of Washington? Or your assessment overall?
Well, the Americans are actually trying to change the perception, but not their policy. So while Biden and his regime continues to talk about not providing offensive weapons to the Saudis, but we have seen no evidence that they have stopped supplying weapons to the Saudis, or that they are still providing logistical and intelligence support to the Saudis. So these negotiations that are taking place under UN auspices regarding Yemen, obviously, as Elijah pointed out, these are basically guided by the Americans, because America virtually controls the United Nations, and so it is actually dictating the agenda. But what is important and crucial for your viewers to understand is that the Yemenis, throughout this war on them, have maintained the high moral ground. The Saudis have been attacking civilian infrastructure. The Yemeni Ansarullah fighters have not attacked any civilian infrastructures. They have targeted military installations. They have targeted economic installations. There is only one instance, in fact, when the Yemenis fired a missile at a palace in which they thought the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman was staying. So throughout these 6+ years, the Yemenis have only targeted military installations because they do not believe in inflicting civilian casualties, although they can. So on these counts, I think the Yemenis really maintain the high moral ground, and they are fully justified in not accepting any demands that the Americans make of them.
Well, Elijah, what about Riyadh itself? Do you think it is looking for a way to end this war now?
Riyadh is really willing to come out of this problem that Saudi Arabia put itself in, and we cannot exclude the meeting, the couple of meetings that happened between Saudi Arabia and Iran in Baghdad, where the Saudis on the top of their agenda was the situation in Yemen. And we saw how Minister Zarif went to Muscat, Salam, to slow down on the base that the Saudis will lift the siege. And the Yemeni made it very clear, we cannot stop the war on our side because the Houthis are now dictating the battle. They said, we cannot stop the war on our side unless you lift the siege, and we will not accept an exchange of ceasefire in exchange of humanitarian aid. You allow us to survive, you allow us to live. We want the 16 ships that are full of oil. There is no oil in Yemen today, and we want all the aids before we start talking about a ceasefire. Today, Saudi Arabia is trembling of the idea that the Houthis are going to liberate Marib, and this is going to happen very soon. And I think they will liberate Marib and get their oil rich accepting a ceasefire.
Okay. Well, Zafar, there seems to be a unique strength and determination in the Yemeni people. I mean, what is it that makes them so determined, although the Saudi regime is killing civilians on a regular basis, as well as destroying the infrastructure, restricting basic necessities, and at least 16 million Yemenis are estimated to be food insecure out of a population of 29 million, and they have refused to surrender to the Saudi regime. And you touched on this a bit, but I'd like for you to expand on it.
Sure. Basically, as I mentioned, the Yemeni people are absolutely brilliant fighters. There are very few other people in the world, perhaps I might even mention the Afghans, who have defeated now the third superpower of their time. But the Yemenis are absolutely determined fighters. But what is also very crucial to keep in mind is that the Yemenis don't rely only on weapons, they rely on their faith. They have a firm conviction in God's help. They are very, very determined people. They are very pious people. As I mentioned, they have not targeted civilians in Saudi Arabia, although they are quite capable of doing it, which shows that they have maintained the high moral ground. They have maintained their dignity and their honor in the face of all of these extremely difficult conditions that have been imposed upon them. I mean, you know, a country that is under total siege, they cannot get food in, they cannot get oil in, and you know, millions of people are starving. More than 1 million children are afflicted by cholera epidemic. I mean, this is absolutely unheard of in recent history. And yet, the Yemenis have maintained their dignity and honor because they have such strong commitment to Allah and to Islam, mm-hmm. and they want to maintain that. And that is the reason why they have been successful. And I think we should take heart from this fact that whenever Muslims, regardless of where they are, for instance, you can look at the situation in Palestine, in Gaza, again, the commitment of the people of Palestine and their firm commitment to Allah has provided them these opportunities. So I think this is a very important lesson for Muslims worldwide,
okay.
that instead of relying on weapons, they can rely on the help of Allah and remain steadfast.
Well, what about that, Elijah? You heard Zafar, he talked about Palestine. I want to look at this because something else unique about the Yemenis, despite all of the hardships that we've just mentioned, some of them, they've recently been raising money for the Palestinians after the situation that took place, 11 days onslaught, Israeli onslaught on Gaza. They have been busy raising money and giving support to the Palestinian cause, despite them being under such pressure. Now, both of these groups, it's interesting, if we look at the similarities of what's happening in Gaza and what's happening in Yemen, both under siege, and the resistance, despite this pressure, both being effective. Your take on this?
This is a very important question. Apart from the touching move of the Yemeni, who are really starving and have very little asset, they managed to put together over $200,000. I mean, look at the amount they managed to put together to send it to Gaza and to support the Palestinian population. This gest is very significant, but the most significant, we see how the axis of the resistance that goes from Yemen to Tehran, to Baghdad, to Syria, Damascus, and to Lebanon, and to end in Gaza, how it is all compact and it's holding together. When Yemen came out and said, we are waiting for Gaza to tell us if they need us to fight and to support them, this is extremely significant, because that is the work of all these years, to bring out a line of population ready to fight against the aggressor, whoever they are, wherever they are, whoever they are. Because even if they are very strong, the people of Yemen express their solidarity with Gaza to tell them that you are not alone and this whole front is here to support you. The creation of this front is the most significant issue in all of this.
Zafar, your take on this resistance front and being in solidarity now, of course, had been before, but definitely seeming to be even more effective than it has been. Your assessment?
Absolutely. In fact, as we see these developments unfold, the resistance front is gaining more and more strength. And this clearly indicates that the resistance front, which obviously the Islamic Republic of Iran is a major component of, has been motivated to a level whereby these resistance fighters are not guided by any worldly considerations, but in fact they are determined to uphold truth and justice, whether it is in Yemen, in Gaza, in Lebanon, in the rest of Palestine, in Iraq, where they are facing this American occupation, or in Syria, which again is has been subjected to the horrendous mercenary onslaught from all over the world, and of course with the American forces over there. But the fact that the Islamic Republic was upfront in supporting Syria, because Syria is a very, very important component for the resistance front in order to be able to provide material support to Hezbollah in Lebanon, as well as material support to the people of Gaza. So we see that the resistance front is actually operating on very high moral principles and upholding justice and fairness. And I think any people that stand up for truth and justice and show solidarity, I think ultimately they will triumph.
And Elijah, your take, now that not only the resistance front, but we look at Yemen itself, the military and Ansar Allah, the Houthis are getting stronger by the day. Do you see a light at the end of the tunnel as far as this war? Do you think that we're heading towards the end of the Saudi onslaught on Yemen?
Actually, I do, because today we see the axis of the resistance coming together, but we also see another element wherever there is an attack against one member of the axis of the resistance. The operational theater can be anywhere in these countries, and we're talking about Yemen, Iraq, Lebanon, Syria, and Gaza. And this solidarity is forcing the other side, who is fighting in these countries, particularly the United States, to stop this war, to try to do something to stop this solidarity that is already made and nothing can stop it. Therefore, I think the Saudis are really seriously going toward a ceasefire because they have lost the battle and they want to end it, come out with the less damage possible. Therefore, the negotiation that is happening in Muscat today, they are trying, the Americans are trying to gain some ground, and the Houthis are very firm, and they will continue to do so. And I think it is an advantage of the Saudis and the American to end this war, and I think this is going to happen most probably this year.
All right, and on that note, appreciate both of you being with us for this debate. Zafar Bankash, Director of Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought out of Toronto, and Elijah Mahnier, journalists and political analysts out of Brussels. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Suratul Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses and then we'll be back. So stay with us.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful. The eminent among those who disbelieved from his people said, "This is not but a man like yourselves who wishes to take precedence over you. And if Allah had willed to send a messenger, he would have sent down angels, We have not heard of this among our forefathers. He is not but a man possessed with madness, so wait concerning him for a time.
As you may remember, previously we started talking about the second section of this chapter, chapter Mu'minun, which the Almighty Allah is talking about saving the Prophet Noah and his followers, this arch prophet, the bearer of the news of monotheism, was answered by the people, the chiefs of the disbelieved from among his people. And they said, مَا هَذَا إِلَّا بَشَرٌ مِثْلُكُمْ. He is nothing but a mortal like you. يُرِيدُ أَن يَتَفَضَّلَ عَلَيْكُمْ. He wants to gain superiority over you. وَلَوْ شَاءَ اللَّهُ لَأَنزَلَ مَلَائِكَةً. And if Allah had pleased, he could have sent down the angels. And at last, مَا سَمِعْنَا بِهَذَا فِي أَبَائِنَا الْأَوَّلِينَ. We have not heard of this invitation from among our ancestors. Now, in the 25th verse, they continue saying, إِنْ هُوَ إِلَّا رَجُلٌ بِهِ جِدْنَةٌ فَتَرَبَّسُوا بِهِ حَتَّى حِينٌ. He is just a man in whom is a madness, so beareth him for a while. So these were all the reasonings they brought to mislead their people. But these baseless words did not affect the soul of this great prophet. So Noah continued his mission without the slightest sign of self-aggrandizement in what he was doing. When they saw that their accusations were not supported by reality, they made another accusation. They said he was insane, a charge that had been leveled upon all divine prophets and the righteous leaders in the course of history. They said, إِنْ هُوَ إِلَّا رَجُلٌ بِهِ جِنَّةٌ. He is just a man in whom is a madness. So you can clearly understand, dear listeners, that obstinacy, conceit, sometimes makes some to lead some individuals to attribute madness to their prophets, the wisest of the people on earth, the messengers of the Almighty Allah. But the elite from among the blasphemers imagine the call of the prophets to be a mental aberration and ask others to wait until he ceases asserting his claims. This is what they understand of all the divine rules and orders.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of his divine
in this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
In huwa illa rajulun bihi jinna. The word jinna is translated as madness here. But it is really interesting that this Arabic word is a kind of madness. And the interesting point is that they use this word in the accusations they leveled at this great arch prophet, suppressing the fact that the life and speeches of this prophet were the best indicators of his knowledge and reasonableness. But here in this case, obstinacy causes the people to be blind. In truth, they intended to say that granted his behavior might be correct and sound, but madness could have many faces, among which is that very appearance of reasonableness and knowledge. So this reasoning was quite interesting, and it was really conceiving, and they were successful at it. They could bring loads of people to their side, these disbelievers. Of course, the leaders from among these disbelievers. At the end, the verse says, so bear with him for a while. فَتَرَبَّسُوا بِهِ حَتَّى حِينَ. This Quranic phrase, فَتَرَبَّسُوا بِهِ حَتَّى حِينَ, may refer to the possibility that they were anticipating Noah's death. So, as a result, they could get peace of mind. Of course, it could mean that they were waiting until he was cured from the sickness of madness that they had attributed to him. But it seems that because of his old age, they were waiting for him to die. At any rate, they made three kinds of unfounded and paradoxical accusations, each of which they advanced as a reason to deny his prophecy. We will, inshallah, talk about this more in the next program. We ask the Almighty Allah to sit us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
with reporters.
According to British daily The Sun, the U.S. is going to follow a complex strategy regarding the withdrawal of its troops from Afghanistan. The Sun reported that Washington is going to keep hundreds of its forces in the country in order to avoid the collapse of Kabul by Taliban. According to the report, 600 U.S. Marines could be deployed to protect the U.S. embassy in Afghan capital. British and Turkish troops may reportedly assist the U.S. forces. However, experts here believe such a move is part of Washington's psychological war against Afghans after spreading further fear among locals.
The U.S. is after wickedness. It threatens us of the consequences of its withdrawal, such as the fate of women's rights. But we ask them to just leave our country. We know how to deal with the challenges.
In the meantime, many here name the U.S. government as a symbol of imperialism that doesn't care about basic issues such as peace, human rights, and liberties.
It's very naive to think that American came here to do anything with poverty, to do anything with peace building, to do anything with democracy or human rights. In fact, it's the other way around. The American presence, not in Afghanistan, but in the region and in the world, in the bigger picture, is to create more conflict, is to create more poverty, is to create more dependency to the United States.
As observers say, the U.S. and its allies want to draw a dark picture for the future of Afghanistan. Under such a scenario, the Afghan government will soon collapse by the Taliban and the country will go back to 1990s. In such circumstances, political elites in Afghanistan say, since Afghans have fully experienced the cost of foreign interference in their country over the past four decades, they need to firstly come together and make a united nation and then make a strong policy to deal with foreign players in line with their own national interests. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Hundreds of pro-Palestine protesters gathered outside the BAE Systems factory in Blackburn in the north of England to call upon the weapons manufacturer to stop supplying components for F-35 fighter jets that have been used in the recent bombardment of Gaza.
BAE, which is one of the largest companies in the UK supplying arms, parts of jets, fighter jets, to the Israeli terrorist state, which is bombing children, killing innocent people, and BAE is also funding other oppressive regimes like Saudi Arabia, and their arms are destroying the lives of innocent people.
The protest came on the back of one of the largest pro-Palestine demonstrations in British history on Saturday, and similar demonstrations throughout the week led by Palestine Action Group, who have been protesting outside the Israeli-owned Elbit Systems factory that provides drones, weapons, and military hardware to the Israeli army.
We've seen protests in Leicester, Tamworth, Oldham, and today in Blackburn as the anger amongst the British public begins to swell at the thought that British weapons are being used by the Israeli army to kill Palestinian children.
They're shooting kids, murdering little children. If that was their children, what would they say? So us lot standing here, we're going to stand out here and we're going to make noise for our people, our brothers and sisters are being oppressed. Free, free Palestine!
The name of the Jewish people is being misused. And the term anti-Semite, so-called anti-Semite, is being thrown around. Anyone who dare criticize strongly what the Zionists are doing is labeled as a Jew hater, and it's not true.
It's become increasingly clear that the British government's unwavering support for Israel is not representative of the feeling on the ground, with more than 383,000 Brits calling on their government to sanction the Israeli regime for their crimes against the Palestinian people. But while the UK remains complicit through the hundreds of millions of pounds worth of weapons sold to the Israeli army, some might wonder if the UK should also be held accountable. Ahmed Cabello, Blackburn.
To continue supporting the Palestinian cause, Yemen Zakat Authority has organized this event to distribute cash aid among the Palestinian community in Yemen and fundraise $1.5 million to the Palestinian resistance.
Today, we are honored to launch two projects.
The first one is distributing cash aid among our families and brothers from the Palestinian community. We're also donating money to support the Palestinian resistance.
The head of the Zakat Authority said the Palestinian resistance proved it is capable of standing against Israel. Yemenis said what was presented in the ceremony is part of what is coming, as Yemenis promised to support Palestinians until the liberation of their occupied lands.
There is no doubt that the amounts provided by the General Authority for Zakat are a simple contribution from the Yemeni people, who are ready to even share their food with the Palestinian people. Yemenis hope that this money will help liberate Al-Aqsa Mosque from the Israeli occupation, and we believe that the Palestinian resistance is capable of doing this.
The leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement, Abdul Malik al-Houthi, called on Yemenis to stand by Palestinians, saying they will share a living if they have to. He urged Yemenis to carry on the fundraising campaign to help Palestine.
Despite being involved in a brutal war by the Saudi-led coalition, Yemenis say they will also stand by their Palestinian brothers with everything they have, even if they have to share a living. Abdul Latif Washali, Sana'a.
The seven candidates of Iran's 13th presidential election appear on TV and radio channels to convince voters by giving details of their programs. This time, due to the corona pandemic, campaigns mainly go on through TV channels and social media platforms.
My first priority is the production. I will boost the country's production and fight economic corruption.
The other one said it is time for a revolution in management methods and mechanisms of running the country.
It is time for deeper changes. A revolution is needed in management, which means an administration that fully merges with the people.
The next one was Mohsen Mehralizadeh, who said that production and creation of jobs will be among the top priority issues to be addressed.
I will take a serious step toward production and creation of jobs in the beginning of my administration, which is due to start in the second half of this year.
Abdel Nasser Hemmati, who is the current governor of Iran's central bank, emphasized that today nothing is more important than improving people's livelihood.
We must boost production through interaction in order to improve the livelihood of people.
Mohsen Rezaei, who has vied for the post several times, said he would appoint women in his administration.
Definitely, I'll use women in my cabinet, and at least two of my cabinet members will be women. The housewives would also get the necessary facilities to be able to earn money.
Earlier, Ebrahim Raisi also noted that the participation of youth in the electoral process will create a bright future for economic independence and prosperity. Campaigning for the seven candidates got underway on Thursday and will continue until the day before the election day. Human Abadi, Tehran.
According to Afghanistan's public health ministry, the third wave of COVID-19 is sharply spreading across the country and the government is bracing for the plight. As officials say, the government's decision to put a two-week ban on nearly half of the educational centers and universities is considered a precautionary measure to avoid further spread of the disease in the country. The public health ministry has also urged locals not to violate health protocols. However, locals here believe that attempts like this must be associated with other supportive measures by the government in order to convince ordinary people to stay at home.
Our people can't survive without government's financial support during lockdowns because poverty is widespread. Most families here can't survive if their breadwinners stay at home.
In the meantime, some others suggest that closure of educational centers and universities is not enough and that the government must put a ban on activities of all public sites such as swimming pools, wedding halls, sports clubs, and even religious sites.
Confronting the third wave of COVID-19 can be fruitful only if the public and private sectors take it seriously. So all public sites, including swimming pools and wedding halls, should also be put on lockdown.
As observers say, the Afghan government will have a tough task to confront the spread of the third wave of COVID-19 pandemic due to shortage of medical equipment. This comes despite receiving millions of dollars in aid by regional and international states and bodies. Based on official figures, over 70,000 Afghan individuals have been affected by the disease so far, and some 3,000 others have also lost their lives over the past year. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Activists are galvanizing opposition to the government's planned controversial policing bill, which is now close to becoming law, highlighting a number of issues as more Kill the Bill protests are planned.
It's a massive assault on our democratic right to protest in this country. And let's be clear here, this is specifically aimed at the environmental movement, thousands of young people on the streets demanding that we tackle the climate emergency, and the Black Lives Matter movement, thousands of young people on the streets demanding justice for black people. And when the government saw these two movements in the summer of last year taking to the streets as they did, they decided that they needed to put in place the most draconian legislation.
Many anticipate a new wave of protest as concerns over the right of assembly grow.
I think this will be the government's poll tax movement moment, and we'll see thousands and thousands and thousands of people in cities right across the country, as we have over the last 3 months, stepping up the campaign against this bill. But it's an absolute disaster for democracy in Britain.
The bill could also have a devastating impact on other marginalised communities in Britain.
This government is conducting a culture war. That's what it's doing. It's trying to undermine and eliminate aspects of black culture, Muslim culture, traveller culture. And when you think that people have had a way of life for thousands of years, and now you're going to introduce legislation, rather than facilitating their way of life as British people within a multicultural democracy, you're actually going to introduce a law that denies them their very way of life.
Criticism of government plans will continue amid fears that the potential damage might be irreversible.
The Police Crime Sentencing and Courts Bill continues to see mass opposition up and down the country, with experts deeply concerned about the potential long-term impact on civil liberties. Richard Sudamp, London.
At a summit in Brussels, EU leaders have taken the highly controversial decision to advance plans on the vaccination of children against COVID-19. The European Commission says more than 300 million doses of COVID-19 vaccine will have been delivered to EU member states by the end of this week.
If we continue like this, we have confidence that we will be able to safely reopen our societies. So we must now focus on consolidating this progress. One important element that we've been discussing is the vaccination of minors.
EU leaders have chosen to completely ignore a plea from the World Health Organization. The WHO clearly states that vaccinating children and other low-risk groups in the EU happens at the expense of health workers and high-risk groups in poorer countries. The People's Vaccine Alliance is a coalition of more than 50 organizations. In an extensive survey of epidemiologists commissioned by the Alliance, two-thirds warned mutations could render current COVID vaccines ineffective within a year. Hence the need, they stress, to vaccinate the world, not just rich countries. EU leaders are under enormous pressure to somehow save the bloc's floundering economy, and they see the vaccination of their own people as the key. Millions have lost their jobs in the EU. Young adults have been worst affected. Experts we have been speaking to say the EU has given young people limited skills, particularly when it comes to the digital economy.
We need to change and constantly update our educational systems. And not only educational, we need to speak about the learning as such, which is much wider concept than what is being taught in schools.
The EU is facing unparalleled economic and social crises. Critics say the vaccine rollout was happening much too slowly. Now, as it speeds up, it's perpetrating, quote, scandalous inequality in the context of poorer countries, according to the WHO. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
On April 6, 1994, an airplane carrying then Rwandan president Juvenal Habyarimana was shot down as it prepared to land in Kigali, killing everyone on board. Military commanders of Rwanda's Hutu-dominated republic announced the president's death, blaming the Rwandan Patriotic Front, RPF, an organization dominated by the rival Tutsi minority, for the attack. Within a few hours, the commanders ordered people of Hutu identity to spare no Tutsi in the country, including infants. The mass killings went on for around 100 days, leaving at least 800,000 people dead. During Habyarimana's years in power, France maintained close relations with him as part of its France-Afrique policy. The French assisted Rwanda militarily against the RPF during the country's civil war in the years before the massacre. In the first few days of the genocide, Paris launched a military operation to evacuate French expatriates from Rwanda, refusing to allow any Tutsis to accompany them. According to the Human Rights Watch, the French military presence after the killings also effectively helped the perpetrators of the genocide to escape to neighboring countries. The question of France's role and responsibility in the genocide has burned between the two nations for decades. However, ties have warmed under French President Emmanuel Macron. Macron made a symbolic visit to Rwanda after three decades of diplomatic tensions. His highly anticipated speech fell short of a formal apology, but he recognized his country's responsibility.
Ever since 27 years of bitter distance passed, 27 years of incomprehension, of a sincere attempt to get closer that was unsuccessful, 27 years of suffering for those whose intimate stories remain mishandled because of the antagonism of the memory, and so with modesty and respect by your side today, I come to recognize our responsibility.
Even though the French president tried to reconcile with Rwandan people, genocide survivors were disappointed at Macron's failure to offer a clear apology.
We remember the French who went to the checkpoints, who worked with the ex-government, and who helped them to distinguish between the Tutsis and the Hutus. I mean, it is very... we cannot forget that easily. We need to be honest. They have participated. They helped. It was time to say sorry, without going around it.
The official report of the latest inquiry in France's role in the genocide, commissioned by Macron in 2019, said that Paris was responsible but not an accomplice. The report, along with the lack of an apology from Macron, shows that France still does not want to admit its complicity in the 1994 genocide.
Elections ended on Thursday after millions of Syrians cast their ballots on the 26th of May to choose one of the three presidential candidates as the nation's next leader. Speaker of Syria's People's Assembly, Hamoud Essabagh, announced the final result in a press conference.
I am delighted and honored to announce the victory of Bashar Hafez al-Assad as the president of the Syrian Arab Republic. I express in the name of the Syrian People's Assembly our pride and appreciation and congratulations to our great Syrian people who voted for a free and great leader.
More than 13 million Syrians out of 14 million voted in favor of Assad. People filled the streets and main squares of major cities, celebrating what they say is a victory against all states that opposed the elections. Chanting slogans in support of President Bashar al-Assad, Syrians danced, sang, and expressed in all ways possible their feelings for their leader.
Western enemy countries' economic sanctions caused food and basic supply shortages in Syria, which forced Syrians to line up for hours at shop stores. Those countries today are definitely surprised to see those lines of people on the streets now expressing their love to President Assad in Syria. We will continue supporting Assad even if bread, water, food and gas are not available.
We are gathering today in all squares to tell all countries of the world that no country will defeat us, no matter how much plots they hatch. We are with Assad and we are steadfast. We all love President Assad.
Currently, Syrians' main demand is for President Assad to improve the economic situation in the country, which is suffering under harsh economic sanctions imposed unilaterally by the West and the United States.
It's a historic moment in Syria, and Syrians have made that clear on the streets. They are celebrating victory over all states that wanted to forcibly topple the country's president for years, that they are the owners of this land and have the right to determine their country's future. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
The president of the UN General Assembly visited Pakistan. Volkan Buzgar met senior Pakistani authorities, including Foreign Minister Shah Mahmood Qureshi. His agenda includes regional and international issues, including Palestine, Kashmir, and the Afghan peace process. At a news conference, the president of the UN General Assembly made it clear no one can remain impartial in the face of